Good afternoon, TGP Wardville. This is In the Know, episode 5. It's Monday, July 12th, 2021, also known as my wife's birthday. So if you know Emily and you have her contact information and you feel so inclined, please reach out to her, give her some encouragement, tell her happy birthday. I know that'll make her happy, and just tell her I sent you. She'll know what it means. Seriously, just tell her I sent you. A couple of announcements before we begin the newsletter sermon follow-up that we usually do. The most pressing thing that's happening in our church right now is VBS. That is going to happen from July 28th through the 30th. It's a Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. It's going to be from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. You can register online, register your children online. We also need volunteers. So if you are able, please talk to Catherine about how you can get involved with that. The theme of VBS this year is going to be Creation for His Glory. It's going to involve original Bible studies, themed snacks, and original music, TGP original music. I'm so excited about VBS, and I hope you are too. Let's get behind that and pray for it, volunteer for it, sign your kids up for it, and get the word out. That is all going to culminate in a back-to-school bash on July 31st. There's still some details that are TBD, but that's going to happen. I would like for, in your mind, you to include that as part of VBS. Don't think there's VBS and then there's a back-to-school bash. The back-to-school bash is kind of an end of VBS. So there are those two things, the VBS, back-to-school bash, all one sort of event that week. The last thing I want to say is there is a prize drawer. We've talked about this before. I've got this prize drawer that's going on, and I have a trivia question that's going to come out in the newsletter. You're going to have to go into the newsletter and find the trivia question and find the answer to the trivia question. I'd prefer you didn't Google the question, but that you actually found it in the Bible. Send me a verse reference. The first two people to send me an answer to that question will get to pick from the prize drawer. All right, let's jump in to the sermon follow-up. I warned you yesterday, it's going to be long. You know, it's not as long as I thought it was going to be. It's still kind of long, but it's not as long as I thought it was going to be. So let's just jump right in. We have a lot to discuss. First, who or what was Melchizedek? Melchizedek is such an interesting, mysterious, intriguing figure. It should be no surprise, therefore, that speculation abounds. There is so little said about him that the door is seemingly left open. But admittedly, even what is said about him is incredible. Hebrews 7:3 says all these things. No parents, no mother or father, no genealogy, no beginning and no end. He continues as a priest forever. And so a number of major theories about his identity have arisen because of both what is and isn't said about him. Now, I sort of mentioned these yesterday. I'm just going to go back through them really quickly. Some maintain that he is a Christophany. So if you think back, maybe you know this, maybe you don't. A theophany, let's break that word down. Theos equals God. So we get theology from the study of God. Theos, logos, study of God. Theos is God. Phaneros is revealing, manifesting, appearing. So a theophany is a manifestation of God in the Old Testament. A Christophany, then, would be a pre-incarnate manifestation of the Son of God. Right? So that's the Old Testament Christophany. Jesus shows up before Jesus is born. Because of the exalted language about him in Hebrews 7, some conclude that Melchizedek was a pre-incarnate Christ, somehow reigning as king and priest there in Salem. Now, side note, there was a time when I actually held that position. I don't anymore, but I did for a little while. And so I'm sympathetic to it. I understand why people want to say that. Other people maintain that he is an angel. Now, you think about it, angels don't have mother or fathers. They do have a beginning, right? They were created beings, but they continue forever. And they're very interested in the worship of God, which so are priests. So that makes sense. Angels were known at times, even in the Old Testament, and sometimes perhaps in the New Testament, if you read Hebrews 13:2, to take on human form. Now, they don't look like humans normally, but they can appear as humans. So others have come to believe that this was true of Melchizedek. And Kenneth Matthews' commentary makes the point that actually some thought he was the archangel Michael, and that because of that, there were some heretical cults which popped up in certain communities. And I think it's interesting, one of the things that I'm blanking right now on the book of the Bible that this is, I think it might actually be in Hebrews, that talks about don't devote yourself to the worship of angels and to Jewish myths. And I think that's some of the stuff that he was talking about. I think it's from Paul. It might be from Hebrews or it might be from Paul. But I think they're pointing out like that's not what you need to devote yourself to. But there are people who believe he is an angel. And then still others believe he was just a man who was a priest of God and the king in Salem. Now, some early Jewish interpreters who thought this actually, and this is also from Kenneth Matthews, also thought that he was Noah's son Shem. Now, I'll just tell you, I don't agree that he was Shem, but I do agree that he was just a man. That seems to be the best fit of the narrative of Genesis. Like, I don't have any reason to believe, like, the king of Sodom or Methuselah or Enoch or Seth, for instance, were anything other than men. Nothing is said about him in this passage that makes us think he's anything other than just a human being. Ultimately, though, this entire discussion turns upon whether or not the author of Hebrews intends what is said of Melchizedek here in Hebrews 7 to refer to a figurative or a literal sense. If it's figurative, the author of Hebrews applies what's not said about Melchizedek in Genesis. So, for instance, he has no recorded genealogy. He's not given a backstory, thus he has no beginning. He doesn't have a mother or father named. There's nothing said of his death, so therefore he continues as a priest in a figurative sense. Right? So they say that in a metaphorical sense, and the author of Hebrews is stating this metaphorically to draw connections between him and the better priest, Christ, Jesus, of whom these things are actually true. Now, according to the flesh, he did have a mother, but there is no, like, the person of the Son of God did not have a mother. He has always existed. He will always exist as God, the Son. If the words of Hebrews are intended literally, then it seems like it has to be one of the other two options. So he's of the archangel Michael, or the pre-incarnate Son of God. Now, I didn't know this when I was preparing, but back in May, the Bible Project people put out a couple of podcast episodes about Melchizedek. I'm started listening to one this morning, so I can't recommend it heartily to you because I haven't listened to it all the way through, but they're out there if you're interested. They're talking about the significance of Melchizedek. But what's most important, and I tried to draw this out yesterday in my exposition of these texts, what's most important is not his essential constitution as a person or an angel or the pre-incarnate Son of God. What's most important is that Melchizedek was a king priest. And in the newsletter, I'm going to link to a Gospel Coalition article I found this morning that I think summarizes well much of what I discussed yesterday. It's called "Who is Melchizedek?" The next thing that I want to discuss with you is a little bit of this unauthorized quote king priest from that I mentioned yesterday. So there was a king named Uzziah who arrogates to himself the authority of a priest. That word arrogate, I cannot pronounce words today. I cannot grammar today. Arrogate, that word means to take authority to yourself that's not really yours. So he pridefully enters the temple to burn incense. And when confronted by the high priest, he becomes angry. It's at this point that he breaks out with leprosy on his forehead. He is deemed unclean and has to live as a leper, separate from the people for the rest of his life. You can find that story in 2 Chronicles 26, verses 16 through 23. You know what else is interesting about all this? Now, this is just a side note. But do you remember how in the law, when someone was a leper, I want to say this is like Leviticus 13. I am just ballparking that. Leviticus 13, 14, maybe 15. When someone was a leper, that person had to walk around covering his upper lip and had to shout, unclean, unclean. Well, when Isaiah in Isaiah 6 is swept up into Yahweh's presence and has this vision of the train of Yahweh's robe filling up the temple, when was that? It was in the year that King Uzziah died. King Uzziah, the leper, died, and Isaiah is swept up into this heavenly vision. But what's interesting is, what does he complain about before Yahweh? He says, this is in verse 5, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips." There's a leprosy connection between the year that King Uzziah died and what Isaiah says is true of him. So he's like, I'm ruined, not because I'm one of the subjects of this king, but because I myself am like that leper. I am a man of unclean lips. It's the same word. So besides Melchizedek, so it's like here is an example of a priest or a king who tries to become a priest and unlawfully join these two offices together. And he tries to take to himself authority that's not his. And so besides Melchizedek, the Old Testament generally separates the offices of priest and king. Now let's discuss Matthew 22, verses 41 through 46. I mentioned yesterday that Psalm 110 is important in Jesus' own thinking about his role as Messiah. He quotes it in a question that he poses to the Pharisees. So basically, he asks, he's in the temple, he's teaching, and he asks, "Whose son is the Christ?" And they respond, "David's," which was a well-known fact based on 2 Samuel 7 that one of David's descendants was going to reign as king forever. And so they were anticipating the tribe of Judah for the king. They were anticipating the son of David for the Messiah. So he asked that, and they answer rightfully, David's son. But then he uses Psalm 110 to ask, well, if that's true, how is it possible that David calls him Lord? Because, and then he quotes, "The Lord said to my Lord," David's writing this, "sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet." There's something about pre-existence that seems to mean there would be a preeminence that belongs to David rather than his descendant. So that David shouldn't call his descendant Lord if he's his son. And that's true generally, unless, follow me on this, unless the one who comes after David actually existed before David. So that can only be true, that can only be the case with one who is truly God and truly man. One who is David's son according to his humanity, who is actually born in time, but David's Lord according to the Godhead. He's God and man. So Jesus is using Psalm 110 in Matthew 22 to hint at the fact that the Messiah is God and man, or as one hymn writer worded it poetically, great David's greater son. He's David's son, but he's greater than great David. And the only way that that can be true is if he's God and man who existed before and came after David. He can only be David's son and David's Lord if he's God and man, in fulfillment of 2 Samuel 7. Wow, that's a big deal. So do you see why this psalm mattered to Jesus? And the last thing I want to talk about for just a moment are two other implications of Christ's forever priesthood. So yesterday I talked about the fact that Jesus is going to meet us in all of our tomorrows with his mercy because he continues forever as a priest according to Melchizedek's order. But I also came across a quote from John Calvin that's excellent. I'll quote it at length here because it gets at one of the most glorious and consequential implications of the fact that Jesus is our great high priest forever. Like that we have such a high priest, as the author of Hebrews says. And it basically boils down to what we rightly call the priesthood of all believers. This means that we don't need a priest to go between us and God. We are priests as believers. Jesus is our forever mediator who always brings us directly into God's presence. There is no need for human priests to mediate that relationship any longer. Here's what Calvin said. He, Jesus, was constituted and consecrated priest by the Father with an oath after the order of Melchizedek without end, without successor. That's Psalm 11:4, Hebrews 5:6, and 7:3. He once offered a victim of eternal expiation. Now, expiation means cleansing and reconciliation. And now also, having entered the sanctuary of heaven, he intercedes for us. In him, we are all priests, but to offer praise and thanksgiving, in fine, ourselves and all that is ours to God. It was peculiar to him alone to appease God and expiate sins by his oblation. Oblation is like gift or sacrifice. When these men, the Catholic priests, who would act as priests between God and men, usurp it to themselves, what follows? But that they have an impious and sacrilegious priesthood. That comes from his book, The Institutes of the Christian Religion. He's arguing against priests, like in the Catholic Church, who would say that you need to come to me so that I can mediate to you the forgiveness that Jesus has purchased for you and mediates. It's like a middleman that doesn't have to be there. Calvin's arguing that because Jesus is our high priest who offered a perfect sacrifice for atonement and salvation, all believers are therefore priests who offer thanksgiving and praise as well as their lives and all they have to God in response. But we come to God through Christ, not another human being. We have direct access at all times, in all places. What good news. And one final implication of Christ's Melchizedekan priesthood is that because he is forever, he can continually intercede for us. I was reminded of the significance of this by Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology book. He says this, and it's such a wonderful and joy-imparting thought. He says, we may conclude then that both Paul and the author of Hebrews are saying that Jesus continually lives in the presence of God to make specific requests and to bring specific petitions before God on our behalf. This is a role that Jesus, as the God-man, is uniquely qualified to fulfill. Although God could care for all our needs in response to direct observation, Matthew 6:8, yet it has pleased God in his relationship to the human race to decide to act instead in response to prayer, apparently so that the faith shown through prayer might glorify him. That comes from his Systematic Theology book, page 628. To bring this full circle with the previous point made from Matthew 22, Grudem says that Jesus is uniquely suited to occupy this role as eternal intercessor for his people because he is God and man. To be a priest would mean he needs to be truly human, but to be a forever priest means that he must be truly God, exalted above the heavens. The fact that not only will he minister his mercy to you in all your tomorrows, but actually continues to pray for you is owing to this Melchizedekan type priesthood that he holds as the God-man. In other words, the only reason you ask for bread and get bread, or that you ask for a serpent accidentally, as one preacher has said, and still get bread anyway, is that Jesus is interceding for you even now. Praise his name. So go forth with much confidence in your great high priest. He's yours and you're his. Have a great week. I love you, people.